Welcome to Supersized Science, where we feature research and discoveries nationwide, enabled by advanced computing technology and expertise at the Texas Advanced Computing Center of the University of Texas at Austin. I'm Jorge Salazar, a science writer at TAC. Big challenges demand bold solutions. In 2026, U.S. scientists will gain a new powerhouse for discovery, Horizon, the largest open science supercomputer in the nation. Horizon will accelerate basic research that drives innovation, fuels new industries, and strengthens the U.S. economy while probing the universe's greatest mysteries. Thanks to the National Science Foundation's support for basic and transformative research, TAC began building the U.S. NSF Leadership Class Computing Facility in 2024. The cutting-edge facility represents the next leap in large-scale computing to tackle the most demanding scientific problems in the nation's research portfolio during the next decade. The LCCF's design is being shaped from the ground up by science itself. At its core is the Characteristic Science Applications, CSA, program. 11 cutting-edge software projects built to tackle critical challenges that will define the facility's success. On the podcast to discuss the Characteristic Science Applications program is Dan Stanzione, NSF-LCCF Principal Investigator and the Executive Director of the Texas Advanced Computing Center. Dr. Stanzione, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here, as always.
What's most important for the public to know about the Characteristic Science Applications for the NSF Leadership Class Computing Facility at TAC?
We started that program now several years ago, almost 4 years ago, with sort of three different goals in mind. At the core of the leadership facility is we're building a really valuable, very large computer. And it's really valuable, not just from a scientific perspective, but it also costs an awful lot of money. There's three things you want to achieve there. One is you want to make sure you're building the right system for what scientists are going to need, and that the technologies you've chosen and the way that you've configured it is going to work on those science problems and work in a way that users are willing to accept to do it. And two, you want to be ready to use the first day you put it up because, you know, these things don't last long. Computing technology gets old quickly, so we want it to be useful, doing sort of groundbreaking and cutting-edge things from the first day it's available, essentially, as soon as possible after it's delivered. So that was kind of the second thing. And then the third thing is then we have to prove to everybody that we've done important scientific things and that the machine is as capable as we've advertised. And so we've designed the CSA program to do all three of those things. And the notion was, historically, we've designed machines around a set of benchmarks, right, that are supposed to be representative of the workloads that we're going to run on them. But those benchmarks tend to, you know, they get gamed over time, right? And people build machines around the benchmarks rather than the real science. And the science evolves, and the codes evolve, and the machines evolve, and the programming models evolve. So we needed a new set of benchmarks when we started on this. And when we started planning the leadership facility, it was about 5 years ago. We knew the machines were going to change, and we knew the problems we wanted to run in 2027 to 2031, you know, are not going to match what the benchmarks we had. In fact, the benchmarks we used to design Frontera that we had to submit as part of the competition were from 2006, right? So, you know, we're talking about 20 years of scale where we're running at a, you know, 10,000 times the compute size. We're running at a problems now infused with AI, you know, that weren't infused with AI in 2006, right? Yeah, just the nature of what we were doing was going to change. So we wanted to pick some problems that we could use. One, that we could characterize our decision on the architecture and perform projections. Two, that we could get some real users with real problems involved and keep them involved. Because if you ask people what they're going to do 5 years from now, they're going to give you an answer, but they are not necessarily have any stake in making that actually come true. So we wanted to create a partnership with these science teams where they'd have some skin in the game, essentially, to make sure that we were tracking the problems they really wanted to work on. And if their problems changed, we need to know about it as quickly as possible. And then we also, given that we're building the Horizon machine we're building for the leadership facility, looks a lot different than the Frontera machine, right? For starters, a lot of the performance comes from GPUs, whereas the 2019 machine, most of the performance came from the CPUs. And so that changes which codes work well and what the work we have to do to get those codes ready to go. And so by selecting a bunch of science teams ahead of time, building the machine to fit their problems, and then working with them for multiple years as we get closer to the system, we're sure that we have problems that are important, problems that are relevant to our users, and problems that are going to work at scale on the first day, and problems that we can use to demonstrate the value of, and the performance of the system over time. So that's really the genesis of putting this program together.
Would you discuss some of the science of the characteristic science applications and how that compares to some of the scientific computation that has been kind of like the backbone of TAC for years and years?
It was exactly that, right? We tried to focus on problems that were large. And the problems we've settled on, there's actually a number of factors, right? So we initially got about 160 applications from science teams for potential problems that would be a challenge at the scale and the time frame we were talking about. So we whittled that down to 30 we took a really long look at and did some more homework and research on. And then we worked with 20 for the first 2 years, and then we've actually cut down to 11 for the last 2 years. And these final cuts have been more about how much work was left to do and how much practical progress did we make in the first 2 years, right? So we wanted teams that were engaged and where we felt like we were making a real difference in the code. Some sped up so nicely and easily that we didn't need to do any more work on them. Some looked like it was going to be a long way and we weren't going to get there in two more years, right? So had as much to do with which ones we picked as the final ones as the type of science that they did. But we really ended up with a nice portfolio in terms of, you know, the things that you would want to build the supercomputer for, which means not just collections of small problems that we need to do a lot of, but some really challenging single large problems. And some of them were measuring, they're like, look, if we wanted to do this properly, we'd need, you know, a million days on Frontera, which it's only been up for 1,800 days. So they weren't going to get that, and it's shared among 100 projects. Obviously something where we need a much bigger system to deal with. But, you know, the things where we tend to focus, and this is where we've ended up, right, are stuff where experimentation is hard, right? So it tends to be things working at the very smallest scales, right? So we have projects on characteristics of viruses and basic understanding of them and drug pipelines for them, where everything is sort of at the molecular level. We have some sort of standard model physics things where we're actually going below the atomic level into the quantum chromodynamics and the sort of quark level to look at sort of basic mysteries of matter. So, and again, you can't look at something smaller than an atom with a microscope. The microscope is made of atoms. There's no sort of, experiments are really hard, right? So it supports things like the Large Hadron Collider, where you make little particles go really, take really little particles, make them go really fast and smash them into each other and try and measure the effects. But that's an awfully expensive experiment. And so simulation is really important. And then at the opposite scale, right, if you want to understand the nature of the universe, like we have a dark matter and dark energy related project. And though for the matter we perceive in the universe, fundamentally, if you look at the way the universe behaves and the way the galaxies move and repel each other and attract each other, we don't know where most of the energy and matter in the universe is. It's not observable. It's not in our model of physics at the moment. So, if you want to look at future power sources, the fact that we don't know where most of the energy in the universe is kind of important. And those things are also, you know, when we're modeling how galaxies move and things like that, also hard to set up lab experiments, right? So when you're at these super large scales, so we have a couple of those cosmology problems, we have a couple of those material or virus type problems, we have some sort of mantle convection, earthquake forecast, seismic problems. Again, hard to build a lab for how the Earth's mantle moves and how it causes earthquakes as plate tectonics happen, right? So another thing where you wait and observe, or we can run simulations, right? So that's another critical area at large scale that I think we actually have three projects related to sort of geosciences in either basic mechanisms for plate tectonics or earthquakes, or being able to run big forecasts to characterize risk around earthquakes. Yeah, so like I said, we have the very large, we have the very small. We have one around turbulence, which is important to any sort of interrupted flow. Most things don't have smooth flow. They have the little eddies, you know. You watch a truck go by and you look at a piece of paper that was laying in the road in its wake and it seems to swirl around. It doesn't just get dragged along with the truck, right? That's the result of the turbulence. And so if we're designing hypersonic aircraft, you know, planes that can go a lot faster, we need to understand turbulence if you want get good combustion. You know, if you're burning a material, you get turbulence in the plume. So if we want to make better gas turbines or any sort of combustion go better, you need to understand turbulence. So we have some, turns out to be physically just a really hard problem to model. So we have some giant turbulence simulations that go on there. So we've hit all those sort of classical things in the final 11 problems that we're looking at. And we talk about them internally. We often talk about the code, but it's important that for the CSAs, we didn't just pick the code, right? So the particular piece of software we're running to do this prediction, right? It's having the problem that we want to solve, which is what's the code we're using? What's the data set we're using? You know, what's the scale that we want to run at? Picking like the earthquake simulation, right? You know, do we need to measure the Earth's interior at the resolution of a kilometer, at the resolution of 100 meters? Is 10 kilometers enough? Is it an adaptive mesh of different sizes at different areas of interest? Because you have the piece of software, but even if we make the code work well, it's going to work differently at different sizes and different data sets. So we tried to focus on picking a problem, not a piece of code that we want to make run well. It's what's the science question do we want to answer? What are the software tools? Sometimes it's multiple codes. And what are the data sets we need to get to the answer and really focus on that as our driving question instead of just saying we're making Fourier transforms go faster or something simple like that.
Can you speak to non-scientists and the LCCF?
There's so many ways that it connects, right? And there's short-term and obvious ones like, you know, natural hazards prediction, right? Can we make better hurricane forecasts, give better evacuation maps, better flash flood forecasts, right? There's so many of those things that are sort of immediate and life critical that are relevant to our ability to build accurate models at very large scales. Increasingly AI, you know, and our ability to build large AI models to predict physical phenomena or human phenomena are becoming super important in terms of the economy, right? It's supposed to be a multi-trillion dollar market in a few years. There are things that are a little further out, but still obviously relevant. Cancer research, drug discovery, new therapeutics, right? That are, you know, maybe take a few years to come to market, but have sort of obvious relevance. But there's also all the basic research that really is the stuff that truly changes the world over time, but in on the scale of decades and in ways that aren't necessarily obvious. I was talking to somebody yesterday about, you know, innovations and at this point where China seems to have the lead, but you notice that suddenly your cell phone is talking to satellites a lot more than it used to. It used to just receive GPS signals and get position from satellites. Now you can actually make a call through a satellite network with most of the phones, or at least do a 911 call, even if you can't send a video over those links yet. It's still at roughly the same power that we were running cell phone calls off of for the last 30 or 40 years, right? It's just a couple of watts, and we can talk to a low orbiting satellite. The things like Starlink clusters, right, that are a couple hundred miles from you, but straight up. There are some innovations out of China where at that same power, you can talk to even higher orbiting satellites, which means we can get geosynchronous ones, you know, that are thousands of miles away. You know, ultimately, we'll get a lot more bandwidth, you know, out of those things. So talking to a satellite 20,000 miles away with 2 watts of power is something that 20 years ago, I would have thought was theoretically impossible, right, that we can do now. If you look at longer term, I was reading again, you know, probably the most economically important discovery of the 20th century till now is the transistor, right? At the basis of all of our electronics, all of our communication systems, all of our entertainment systems, pick an industry, right? You know, make it through your day without touching a transistor. I dare you. It's not possible at this point. So first of all, it came from a lab whose sole job in life was to try and make the phone system better. How do we make clearer telephone calls and better capacity telephone at Bell Labs? And they sort of knew what they needed. You know, it was built to be an amplifier of a signal. But the real challenge, I mean, there were many challenges, but one of the big ones was materials. It was basic research that led people to, you know, the discovery of semiconductor materials. Most of that, and we have a project in the CSAs that happens to relate to this, right, is they noticed that there were materials that behaved differently from an electrical perspective based on what light they were exposed to, which is why we also use the same sort of semiconductor materials and solar cells that we use to make transistors, is because, well, you can change how it conducts based on either applying a current to it or putting light onto it, you know, applying external energy to it changes the way it conducts. So, you know, this make the phone system better turned into a material science problem. And in the early days of the phone system, it was try different materials. Let's try some copper. They tried wood blocks to mount things. They tried, you know, charcoal filters in the phones to do amplification and all sorts of things. But then they discovered with silicon and all the semiconductor materials, starting with germanium, it was how much of particular kinds of impurities you could put in them that change the behavior. So now it's like, well, how many materials are there in the universe? You take the periodic table, you come up with all the possible combinations, and you get a number in the quintillions pretty quickly. And then you say, okay, what are all the things we could put in those as an impurity in some combination? And at what concentration and at what temperature to mix them in? And you suddenly realize there's an infinite number or darn close to an infinite number of possibilities for materials. And now that we use materials that you can't just go mine out of the ground, that require significant processing to get where they are, to make almost every device that you use, from most of the parts of your car to most of the parts of your phone to most of the parts of your refrigerator. These are all areas that we have to explore computationally now, because nobody can sit down and run 10 trillion lab experiments on exotic materials where you take, what if it's 1% of silicon and what if it's 2% of, you know, N-type doping in this particular silicon or gallium arsenide or germanium compound, indium phosphide, take your pick. Drug discovery is a similar thing, right? We know how to make billions of compounds. There's trillions more that we don't know how to make. How do you mix them? How do they work against a person who has billions of characteristics in their genome? All of these things require the ability to do predictions at massive scale, to do virtual experiments at incredible speed. So, you know, again, you can't touch, you know, a piece of fabric, a piece of communications equipment, your watch, your car, your house. You know, Tyvek is not something we cut down in the woods, right? That you insulate your house with, right? It's an engineered material, right? You can't do any of this without our ability to do computation and virtual experimentation around this stuff. So today, it's almost all of the economy, almost all advanced products, you know, are a result of these sort of basic research discoveries. And so we're really, when we do basic research, we're building the future in ways that we can't predict, right? Again, nobody thought we'd get cat videos swarming on the internet from trying to build an amplifier so your phone sounded better, right? And certainly not people who noticed that material acted a little differently because you shined light on it. The people who followed up on that, right, has built every, you know, it's why you don't wait for the mail. You wait for email, very little time, or text messages is how we communicate now, or TV or radio or streaming or... all of that is based on figuring out the transistor, all of which was funding basic research about, hey, these class of materials behave differently when you shine light on them. So those sort of basic questions can have trillion-dollar implications. And so it's critical to invest in them.
Update. Let's start with the LCCF. Could you give us an update on the status of the NSF Leadership Class Computing Facility that's begun construction just north of TAC here in Round Rock, Texas?
That's the new data center for the new machine is being built out in Round Rock, again, about 7 miles from where we're sitting right now at the main TAC office. That is coming along pretty much on schedule. You know, we launched the construction project last July. Since launch, we've stayed pretty well on schedule. We still expect that by the end of this year, 2025, you know, in November and December, we'll be getting the racks in and start to deploy the machine. The data center should be ready to take that hardware. By January, it should be fully commissioned, power tested, and on 24/7. And we should have the first phase of the machine in place and delivered by January. So hopefully by mid-spring next year, we start to run some of these big science problems once we shake out the many thousands of parts going into it and the many miles of cable. Make sure everything's tuned up. We'll start running these problems, I'm hopeful, by February, March of 2026.
And some people that are running, that are starting, they're getting an early start, are the science teams on the characteristic science applications. Could you talk about the status of the CSAs? You know, we talked about the process a little bit and how long scientists are running these applications.
So we have the 11 teams that we're still actively working with to tune up their codes and get ready to run. There's all the ones that we worked with previously that will also get early time on the machine to run some problems at scale. We built a bridge system actually in the summer of 2024 that looks more architecturally like Horizon than Frontera did, our Vista system with the Grace Hopper NVIDIA chips in it. So, and then the Blackwell follow-on to that is what will be in Horizon. We've been porting codes over to that platform. We've been tuning the performance and the I.O. We've seen some significant speed-ups, some cases outrageous speed-ups because we've made algorithmic changes to the way they do the problem. We get something for free from the hardware of how fast it runs on the new hardware, but we've, you know, fixed perhaps, you know, the way it loads data, and you get another factor of 3 or 4, you know, out of those kinds of things. So we've made pretty good progress on all the 11 that we're still working with. You know, I think in the worst case, we're projecting a problem that'll run about 8 times faster than it ran on a big chunk of Frontera running on a similar size chunk of Horizon. to, in the best cases, close to 5,000, where we've changed the algorithm. But in many cases, it's more like 30 than 8. So, you know, our performance projections show that, you know, if we started tomorrow and we could actually get the chips in and get it up, that we could already run some of these problems at really good speed and really good scale. But we'll continue to tune and push and look for ways to make the software better so that we can fit more in, I mean, on the machine. When the time comes, we expect to get the first in-house of our Blackwell chips in the next month or so. And so that'll give us about 4 months to tune before we start getting the production ones. So, but yeah, the work continues and all the teams continue to be engaged.
You've been listening to Dan Stanzione of Tech. Supersized Science is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin. The opinions expressed in this podcast represent the views of the host, not of the University of Texas at Austin. For the Texas Advanced Computing Center, I'm Jorge Salazar.